This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. Every week, this program interviews journalists, activists, policy analysts, scholars, and others about the Israeli occupation and U.S. support for it. The views expressed on the program belong to the host and guests and do not reflect those of the radio station or anyone associated with it. I'm Margot Patterson, the host of this week's episode. I'll be speaking today with Juan Cole, a professor of history at the University of Michigan, about President Biden's recent trip to the Middle East. But first, news. In October 2021, Israel labeled six leading Palestinian human rights groups as terrorists, with links to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine political faction. Numerous foreign governments, human rights groups, and UN bodies have denounced the allegations as baseless and politically motivated. Now, Israel is demanding that lawyers representing the six groups receive official permission from the finance and defense ministers to represent the organizations or face a prison sentence of up to 7 years. The Biden administration has so far taken no position on the blacklisting of the six groups, focused variously on children, women, prisoners, agricultural workers, ecology, and international law. On the heels of President Biden's visit to the Middle East, 21 Democratic members of Congress sent a letter to the Biden administration on July 18th, urging it to reject Israel's terrorist designation of the six groups. They note that despite calls by members of Congress to see the evidence for the Israeli charges, none has been supplied to them. In the Democratic primary in Maryland held July 19th, Donna Edwards was defeated in her bid to return to the U.S. House of Representatives. She was the target of a $6 million lobbying campaign by the new super PAC created by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APAC. The powerful pro-Israel lobbying organization established the PAC, called United Democracy Project, just this year to finance political candidates and has already spent $21 million on Democratic primary races. The attack ads funded by that money work to secure reliable pro-Israel candidates, but do not mention Israel. Edwards is thought to have earned the ire of APAC because during her time in Congress from 2008 to 2017, she had voted present on several bills involving aid to Israel that routinely and easily passed. Her election had been championed by J Street, a more liberal pro-Israel group. My guest today is Juan Cole, the Richard P. Murphy Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of Informed Comment, a weblog on foreign policy, and writes frequently about the modern Middle East. Juan Cole, thank you for coming on the program.
It's very good to be here.
You are a non-resident fellow at DAWN, the acronym for Democracy for the Arab World Now, a nonprofit founded by slain Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi to promote democracy, human rights, and the rule of law for people of the Middle East and North Africa. I imagine everyone associated with DAWN must have some mixed feelings about the president's very recent trip to Saudi Arabia in particular. It was a controversial trip. Was it a necessary trip? Do you think anything of benefit will come out of it, either for the American public or for President Biden's own political fortunes?
Well, you're right that members of the organization DAWN are upset by the direct contact that the president had with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The organization was founded by Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered by a Saudi hit team in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul a few years ago. And the CIA assessed that the Crown Prince was involved in this assassination. And so President Biden had campaigned on marginalizing bin Salman because of this murder. And Jamal Khashoggi was American resident and a columnist for the Washington Post. So he was quite a prominent person. Mr. Biden, I think, decided that the difficulties that the world economy was put in by Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine and the consequent high energy prices were damaging to the U.S. and that he needed to reach out to the key members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, among whom Saudi Arabia as the swing producer, to see if he couldn't, if not increase petroleum supplies in the world, which is a little unlikely given that currently Saudi Arabia doesn't have extra capacity, but at least would prevent OPEC from bandwagoning with the Russian Federation, which is a member of OPEC Plus, in continuing to keep supplies tight. I see this more as playing defense than offense.
Do you think he will be successful in keeping Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries
from supporting the Russian Federation in that?
Well, we have to see. OPEC is going to meet at the end of this month and will set further quotas at that point. If we see a loosening of export quotas inside the cartel, then that will be a sign that Mr. Biden's overtures have been well received.
Well, the president did meet with the crown prince. President Biden is said to have brought up Khashoggi's killing. And you wrote in a recent post that the crown prince, in his turn, is said to have brought up the Israeli killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, and the difference in how the Biden administration is treating that death as opposed to Khashoggi's death. The Biden administration has been accused of whitewashing her death. Right before the trip, it said Abu Akleh was likely killed by Israeli fire, but that there is no reason to believe it was anything other than accidental. This, despite the fact that eyewitness testimony and independent investigations strongly suggests that Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli sniper in a targeted killing. I'm wondering about your own response to how the Biden administration has handled the death of these two journalists, and whether you think the Biden administration comes out of this trip with any kind of moral credibility intact.
I'm not sure that in the political world of Washington, D.C., moral credibility is a currency in use. But it is distressing that the State Department whitewashed the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, who was a very prominent American Palestinian journalist who reported for over a decade and a half from the West Bank and Israel for the Al Jazeera satellite network, was beloved by millions. I watched her quite a lot and admired her courage and her honesty. She was wearing a vest and with press printed on it in large letters. She and her team had signaled to the Israeli unit in the area that they were press. She was wearing a helmet. She came under fire and was killed by a bullet that went just under her helmet into her brain. The CNN team that went to investigate found that the other bullets that were fired in the area, including several that hit a tree, were very closely spaced, indicating a deliberate and not a random set of fire. And it's certainly the case that the Israeli military killed Shireen Abu Akleh based on the evidence that CNN presented and eyewitnesses at the time presented. It seems clear to me that she was killed deliberately, that she was sniped at. And this is not the first time that Israeli forces have killed journalists. The Israelis attempted to obfuscate this act. They suggested at first maybe she was killed by Palestinian fire. There were no armed Palestinians in the area. The Israelis actually released video attempting to imply this, which was falsified quickly by investigators. So the Israelis lied, in other words, and attempted to muddy the waters. And when the U.S. finally got around to saying anything at all about it, they relieved the Israelis of any moral responsibility for this assassination without doing an on-the-ground and close check. I think they simply took the Israeli word for it. This is unacceptable. And I have to say that Mohammed bin Salman is the last person who has any moral grounds for criticizing the hypocrisy of the United States in this regard. He makes the fair point that there has been a double standard in U.S. foreign policy towards Israel as compared to other U.S. partners in the region.
Many in Congress, a surprising number, I think, have called for an independent investigation of Abu Akleh's death. Do you see that as a sign that the pro-Israel lobby is losing some of its strength, or not necessarily?
Oh, yes. I think it's 50 or so congressmen have called for an independent investigation, including some congressmen like Bob Menendez, who, as a senator, has been extremely supportive of Israel. So it isn't only a matter of whether one's pro or anti-Israel. This was an American citizen who was killed under very suspicious circumstances. CNN itself tends to paint Israel in a positive light, generally speaking. So the fact that there was a CNN investigation that cast the blame on Israeli snipers is significant. I think a lot of people in Congress would have been reluctant to take a strong stand like this 10 years ago or 20 years ago, when the Israel lobbies were extremely powerful and unopposed. About polling shows about half of Democrats are beginning to have severe doubts about the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. And so there is a sea change in attitude. But again, there are 435 members of the House and 100 senators, so 50 is not very much.
In Jerusalem on July 14th, President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid issued a joint declaration on the U.S.-Israeli strategic partnership and reaffirmed the two countries' ties. Among the pledges made, they vowed that Iran must never be allowed to have nuclear weapons, that the United States' very significant military aid to Israel will continue, and that the two countries will work together to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court. The statement goes on to say, quote, while fully respecting the right to freedom of expression, they firmly reject the BDS campaign, close quote. The BDS campaign is a peaceful effort to pressure Israel to end its military occupation of Palestinian land through boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, all of which have been regarded by U.S. courts up to now as part of free speech. This pledge by the United States to shield Israel from efforts to hold it accountable in the United Nations, in the International Criminal Court, by Americans here at home, certainly does not respect the right of freedom of expression in the United States or anywhere else for that matter. How should Americans regard this pledge that seems to come at the cost of their own liberty? Are these largely empty words? How much energy do you think the U.S. government will put into suppressing the Palestinian human rights campaign?
The state governments in the U.S. have put quite a lot of energy into suppressing the BDS campaign. I can't remember the number exactly.
I think it might be 30 now.
Yes, I think that's right. And that it's something in that order. Of the states have passed laws saying that if you advocate for a boycott, divestment, or sanctions on Israel, that you can't receive state contracts. Now, that might seem a little obscure because how many people have state contracts? But people may not realize that when a professor or a jazz group is invited to a state university campus and given an honorarium, they would now have to sign a pledge that they don't engage in BDS towards Israel. Every time this has gone to federal courts, it's been struck down. The Arkansas Supreme Court has upheld it. It should be pointed out that boycotting had been recognized by the Supreme Court as part of the First Amendment, as part of our free speech rights. And boycotts are routinely conducted against companies that are felt to have morally compromised positions. And they were an important tool in the civil rights movement, where African Americans boycotted establishments that engaged in Jim Crow apartheid-like segregation of the races. Were the Israeli campaign, which is a government campaign, I mean, the Israeli government sends out representatives to meet with state legislators to encourage them to pass these laws, and so to undermine the U.S. Constitution. Were the Israelis to prevail in abolishing the right to boycott, it would be extremely damaging to civil liberties across the board in the United States. And it's shameful, absolutely shameful, on the level of McCarthyism or slavery, that these state legislators have attempted to take away this right.
Do you think this pledge means that the federal government will attempt to take away that right?
I think what it means is that if such a bill came to Joe Biden's desk, he's pledging to sign it. The question is whether Congress would pass such a bill. And certainly the Israel lobbies are encouraging it to do so. I don't know what their chances are. I would have said a decade ago that the state legislators would resist such a campaign because of the First Amendment, but I was wrong. So I can't predict what Congress will do.
If you're just tuning in, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to Professor Juan Cole of the University of Michigan about President Biden's recent trip to the Middle East.
I'm wondering about your response to the Jerusalem Declaration. Was there anything in it that was new? Is there anything in it that gives new reason for concern or for hope?
No, there's nothing new in it and nothing hopeful. The U.S. has a range of relationships with Israel. Foremost in the mind of people like Joe Biden, Israel is a kind of aircraft carrier for U.S. security in the Middle East. And the declaration underlined that kind of cooperation. I think behind the scenes, there was a lot of tension between Biden and the Israeli political leadership because Biden wants to reactivate the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which had put limits on Iran's civilian nuclear enrichment program so as to ensure that there was a long window where Iran to ever attempt to turn towards producing a bomb, a decision it has never made, and there was no active weapons program. But it was a very successful treaty. It was signed by the UN Security Council plus Germany and Iran. And Iran was, according to UN inspectors, in complete compliance with it. In May of 2018, Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the treaty and placed what he called maximum pressure sanctions on Iran that were devastating to the Iranian economy. Now, Iran had signed that treaty in 2015 to reduce the level of its nuclear enrichment activities in order to get sanctions relief. It never really did, because although the UN Security Council revoked international economic sanctions on Iran, the U.S. Congress prevented the Obama administration from doing so. And the U.S. Treasury Department punishes third parties. And so any European firm that invested in Iran, even after 2015, could face massive fines from the U.S. Treasury Department. And so they were all reluctant to do so. So Iran didn't get very much economic benefit from signing that treaty, to its disappointment. And then not only didn't it get an economic benefit, but Trump punished it, even though it was in compliance up till that point, and actually sanctioned the Iranian National Bank, which is unprecedented to sanction the National Bank of a country as a terrorist organization, which meant that any monetary exchange one did in Iran, which went through the central bank as it would, was now a form of terrorism. And it meant that you couldn't even send charitable donations where Iran had an earthquake or something, because you could be accused of giving material support to terrorism. So these were devastating sanctions. And now Mr. Biden wants to convince the Iranians to come back into compliance. And they want to know what's in it for them. What kind of sanctions relief would they get? And how long would it last? Because what if Biden were defeated by a Republican in 2024 and they yet again withdrew from a treaty? So it's been a very difficult set of negotiations. If it succeeded, it would foster peace between the United States and Iran, and I think would be good for peace in the Middle East region, as the original treaty was. But it would also legitimize Iran in the international community. It would lead to foreign investment in Iran, the exploitation of Iran's natural gas fields and petroleum, and potentially make Iran a much more robust country economically and politically. And Israel doesn't want that. And the Gulf oil monarchies like Saudi Arabia don't want that. They're saying they're opposed to the nuclear agreement because they don't believe it can actually forestall an Iranian nuclear weapon. Again, Iran is not assessed by the CIA as wanting a nuclear weapon. And the original 2015 deal succeeded in lengthening the window for any Iranian turn towards such a thing. So the treaty is very successful, but it's being opposed, I think, not on nuclear grounds, although those are the grounds that are given by its opponents, but because they just don't want Iran to be a normal country. They don't want to face a powerful Iran.
As you mentioned,
when the treaty was in effect during the Obama administration, Iran really didn't get as much sanctions relief as it had expected to.
Is the new treaty set up in such a way that Iran can expect to get more benefits than it did during the Obama administration?
There are some things that the Biden administration can do to lift some sanctions on Iran, but the heavy lifting would have to be done by Congress. And unfortunately, we cannot be sure that Biden will have a majority in Congress after November. The executive of the United States is very weak in this regard, and there are some things that it probably just can't legitimately promise. Those sanctions that were placed on Iran by Trump executive order could be reversed, but there are many other sanctions that come from the legislature which would have to be reversed by them, and they may not be willing to do it as they were not willing to do it in the Obama period. That has knock-on effects because, as you say, the Treasury Department punishes third countries and third countries' firms for violating U.S. unilateral sanctions. I think that's a flaw in the international governance regime that the U.S. can do that. It shouldn't be able to enforce unilateral U.S. Decisions, but it does. And it's so far been being accepted by European courts. So nobody wants an $8 billion judgment against them.
You've written that the Biden administration is in danger of being trapped by Israel and Persian Gulf hawks into war with Iran. Could you talk a little bit about how he might be trapped into that war?
I don't think people realize how dangerous the situation now is, in the sense that the United States is conducting economic war against Iran. The kind of punitive economic measures the United States is directing against Iran are unprecedented in peacetime. So it's gone around threatening countries if they buy Iranian petroleum. Well, there isn't any law against people buying Iranian petroleum. It's a perfectly legitimate economic transaction, which, you know, if Iran were a member of the World Trade Organization and it went to the WTO, the U.S. stance would be struck down immediately. But that's how the United States has behaved. So Iran had been exporting 2.5 million barrels a day of petroleum in the late Obama period, once Trump destroyed the nuclear deal and put these maximum pressure sanctions on Iran. It was reduced at one point to exporting 200,000 barrels a day, which is nothing, with the consequent damage to its economy. It is said that over time, Iran developed ways of evading U.S. surveillance and smuggled essentially a lot of its petroleum to China so that it was back up to exporting, Reuters thinks, about 800,000 barrels a day. That's been damaged by the Ukraine crisis because Russian oil has suddenly become discounted on the world market, given that it's under massive sanctions. And so Iran is having trouble competing with the Russian petroleum. In any case, this is an economic war on Iran. It's an attempt to stunt its economy. And it has very harmful effects on civilians and ordinary people, which the United States denies, but it's clear. The U.S. will say things like, well, we don't, you know, interdict the export of medicines to Iran. Well, it may not do so directly, but if you destroy the Iranian middle class and make it so they can't afford pricey medicines, then you're basically denying the medicine. That's what's happening. How long will Iran put up with being treated this way is the question. And it's already has acted out. It has used drones and proxies to attack tankers of the United Arab Emirates in the Gulf. Saudi oil facilities at Upcake were hit, which momentarily endangered about 6% of world oil production. Iran shot down a U.S. drone, a large unmanned vehicle, over the Gulf. For a while there, it looked as though Mr. Trump might bomb Iran over that. He decided not to in the end. But the tension is, you could cut it with a knife, and it's very palpable. And it's not a situation, I think, that can continue indefinitely, this kind of U.S. economic warfare in Iran can turn into a real war, a shooting war at any time. And to the extent that the Saudis and the Israelis are trying to prevent a reduction in U.S. sanctions on Iran, they're, I think, unwittingly, I don't think they realize how bad the situation could get, pushing the United States into a war with Iran.
Let me ask you about something else.
President Biden's visit to Israel and his visit to the West Bank seemed a study in contrast. He was embraced by Israelis and seemed to pledge them all they could want.
His visit to Bethlehem, where he met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, occurred amid protests.
The Palestinians did not get much from this visit other than some humanitarian aid to hospitals in East Jerusalem and an increase in funds to UNRWA, the UN agency that assists Palestinian refugees. During his almost 2 years in office, President Biden has not reversed President Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. He has not reopened the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in Jerusalem. He has not spoken out strongly against continued Jewish settlement. Given his staunch support for all Israeli actions, it doesn't seem that Palestinians can put much hope in the Biden administration doing anything for them. They seem in such terrible straits. Do you see any way forward for them or for their cause right now?
Well, certainly they have no hope from the United States. The United States has been a stalwart in supporting pretty much anything Israel does, including, as we just saw, assassinating American citizens who happened to be reporting from the West Bank. The Biden administration's actions towards the Palestinians are not inconsiderable. I think they're pledging $300 million a year in aid, which is not nothing. And the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which received U.S. funding before Trump, depends heavily on that kind of aid and takes care of the still hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that live in refugee camps into which they were herded by militant Israeli forces when they usurped their land. The $300 million is nothing to sneeze at. I think behind the scenes, Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken do pressure the Israelis on expanding their squatter settlements on Palestinian land in the West Bank. I don't think that pressure has deterred the Israelis in any significant way. It might have affected timing. I don't want to paint with a broad brush here because it's a complicated situation in the Biden administration. Is certainly better on it than Trump had been. But sure, on the big issues, the U.S. just says to the Israelis, knock yourselves out, do whatever you need to do. Here's another $4 billion. And that's not going to change, no matter who's in office.
Juan, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been speaking to Juan Cole, the Richard P. Murphy Professor of History at the University of Michigan. His commentary on politics and foreign policy can be found at Informed Comment, a weblog that offers geopolitical insight for a general audience. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next Friday for another episode of Understanding Israel-Palestine.